Well, Joshua Mosley is a homegrown Texas boy from Dallas, though he is currently living in Philadelphia as associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He got his bachelor's of fine arts from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and his master's of fine arts from the same institution in art and technology. He's exhibited and screened his work all over the world, including Art 33 Basel, MoMA New York, the Reina Sofia in Madrid, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Barcelona, Chicago, Melbourne, London, Rome, Bilbao, Seoul, Tokyo. You kind of get the picture. He also showed work at the International Short Film Festival in Oberhausen, Germany, where he received a special mention. And he also exhibited at this past year's Venice Biennale. And if any of you are going to be in Southern California this summer, you will definitely want to stop by the Museum of Contemporary Art in San Diego, where he'll be having a solo exhibition. Joshua is a recipient of the Rome Prize, the Pew Fellowship in the Arts, the Lewis Comfort Tiffany Foundation Award, and two Pennsylvania Council on the Arts Fellowships. We are quite fortunate to have the artist with us today to explain his work, A View, which opens to the public this weekend. So please join me in welcoming Joshua Mosley.
Thanks for coming. And thanks for doing what you do in helping people to start to see the work and think about it. And I want to answer any of your questions, but I'll talk a little bit about how the ideas came about for this piece and a little bit about how I produced it. And then I'd like to hear any questions that you think will come up as you're taking people around so that I could try to see what answers I would give you if I could answer them now. This is a piece that I completed in 2004. And I worked on it for about 2 years. Then that's not so unusual for the pieces that I've been producing over the last 10 years. It usually takes me a long time to come up with an idea. And I do a lot of drawings, and I think a lot, and read, and use the internet, and look at pictures on the internet, go places, and collect ideas. And I'm never sure whether those ideas are going to stay with the piece or whether they're going to fall beside and not connect. But I have to have a lot of faith in the process. And when I started this piece, I was thinking about the idea of a character who was working all the time, not unlike an animator, but working all the time and completely satisfied with that kind of work. And that's the kind of work that I saw as being a traditional kind of work, like a farmer, where you would do the same thing, and there would be different seasons or different cycles to it, but you would be satisfied with that kind of cycle. And then I thought about another kind of character, the woman who's in the story, who would come in to the film and give it an arc and make it like a story all of a sudden. And I thought about those two different kinds of film structures, as one being like his life being kind of like some of the contemporary videos, video artworks, where it's about a cyclical, infinite cycle. And in a way, that's a really frustrating, pessimistic view of the world, to have something sort of cycling and to be dismal about it. But then I thought that there could be this other arc that's kind of going back to a very human narrative structure that you find in both in contemporary film, but also in ancient stories, where there's a hero's journey and there's kind of a one character meets another character, and they go and they look for something and they find something, and then they come and, you know, they're changed by it. So I wanted to have these two characters sort of describe the opposing parts of those different kinds of stories. I was thinking about other characters in history that had a narrative like life-like, and the first thing that came to mind was George Washington Carver. And I resisted it, and I thought, well, that would be really difficult to work with, because there's so many other parts to him historically, to his story, in terms of his political connection to civil rights, and that I didn't know if I wanted to work with that. And as I started to look at him closer, I realized that he also had a difficulty in his relationship with women, where because of his dedication to work, or maybe because of something else, because of his character makeup, that he wasn't able to have a solid relationship. I thought that sort of resonated with the idea that some people work so hard now, young people work so hard, and they're traveling from place to place, that it's hard to lock down a relationship. He also was an artist. He made paintings, and he made some of the pigments that he used from the minerals in the soil. So he's an agricultural scientist, sort of dabbled in a lot of areas, but one of them was sort of painting. So once I realized that, I decided that might be enough to go on. And I started to create these drawings in the next room, the small charcoal drawings. And I made this story about a park ranger who was cleaning this monument year-round. The monument's 150 feet tall. And one reason, I was playing around with different heights, but I think the reason I stuck with 150 feet is because if you were 150 feet, you could see a perimeter that was as large, and I can't remember exactly the number, it might have been 24 miles or something like that. You could see a perimeter of land that was about the size of the land that he affected by his work, which was traveling around to the farmers in the immediate area and showing them how to work with alternative crops to cotton so that they could continue to be self-sufficient. And in a way, for a lot of African Americans, this was a way that they could be free to be able to grow things themselves, make their own paint for their houses, those sorts of things. And so it was a different way of sort of, instead of a policy, instead of working on civil rights for policy, it was working on civil rights for in a sort of independent, self-sufficient way. And I thought that was an interesting passive approach to politics. The thing that he's holding is a weight that I found on the internet with old cotton scales. That was the weight for balancing the cotton, for measuring the amount of cotton. And I found a photograph of him holding a clump of soil with a peanut plant growing out of it. And I decided that I didn't want to model soil, like a clump of dirt. I'd rather model something that had a little, if it was going to be a 150-foot monument, every part of it would have to have sort of, maybe it should be more of an icon or a symbol, symbolic object. His legs are really large, and then he gets smaller towards the top. And I don't know if that was intentional, but I was sort of modeling it sitting down like this and thinking, you know, constantly kind of looking at it like this to see if it would be, you know, how it would look when I shot it from below. So it's kind of some sculptors who make large monuments usually do the opposite of that. They sort of get bigger, smaller at the bottom and bigger at the top. But this is sort of an inverted monumental scale. So after I had that scale settled, I knew that this size would work for shooting the animation, and I cast it in bronze so that the material would look right. And I worked with a foundry, because I hadn't worked with metals and casting before. And we experimented with different patinas to get something. I wanted something that would both look like it was a piece of indoor sculpture, but also look like when it was photographed, it would look like it had some weathering from the rain, so that there would be a little bits of green kind of coming through in streaks. The next stage was that I had to sort of figure out what the environment would look like. And I teach computer animation at University of Pennsylvania. So for me, sometimes it's quicker to model things in the computer, like an architect would do, than to draw it on paper and sketch it out. Especially with perspective, to do a complex perspective drawing and then decide that I want to shift the camera over a little bit, it's a nightmare, because then you have to do the whole thing over again. So what I wanted to do is I built the whole environment, all the grocery store and the factory and his house. I modeled and the whole park. I imagined the whole park that he lives in, that this monument is standing in and that Henry lives in. And I modeled that on the computer. And then I moved the virtual camera around in the scene to create the points of view that you see in the animation. So just like 3D computer animation in Hollywood, I sort of set different camera angles. Then I rendered out that as an image and printed it out onto a piece of paper. So I had a rendered computer image of the environment. I did that. I printed out three copies of it. So I had three pieces of paper. Each of those pieces of paper, I taped a piece of watercolor paper to the front of it, and then I put that on a light table so I could see the image shining through the computer rendered image. And I painted one brush stroke at a time. I would put one brush stroke on the first painting, then put it on the second painting, and then put it on the third painting. And those are on this wall in this gallery on the back. And you see three images. They look almost exactly the same, but they're different because I couldn't get that brushstroke to be exactly the same. And the effect that causes in the animation in this room is that everything is kind of wiggling. And that effect, I thought, one thing that seems to do is when you have the clay characters, they seem to be very static, blank face, and then the environment seems to be kind of like moving like this, and it seems to create a distance between what's in the environment and what might be happening in their heads or what their thoughts are. It seems to displace the characters from the world that they're in. It seems to be that like there's one kind of pace of the world, and there's another pace of their thoughts that's much slower and contemplative. So I scanned those three pictures into the computer and used the computer to set the colors, I colorized it in the computer, shifting the colors, because these are all black and white, and over there it's color. And that's done digitally. I wanted to do that after, because I needed to figure out what the relationship of the background color would be to the characters, and I wanted it to be subtle and consistent throughout the whole animation to give different tones to different scenes. So I was really lucky to be in this decade where I can do the coloring on the computer and not have to pre-visualize it in the earlier drawing stage. The music, once I had those storyboard images and I was editing, I could start to work with a composer. And we created maybe four different versions of the music, one at a time. It got better and better each time. It was really rough at first. And we kept adjusting the lengths and the tone and the mood of it. The composer works in Hollywood and is trained sort of from UCLA Film School, score construction. So it has a really like a lot of techniques in it that are similar to that in terms of bringing out certain emotions, in terms of the key that that piece of music is in, or the tempo that fit those different scenes. And I think that plays against the minimal dialogue that they have. So that there might be a lot of emotion expressed through the music at some point, but their face is very flat, and the words that they say don't have a lot of emotion in it because there's so much in the music. Okay. The characters that you see in the animation are they have metal armatures, so I can move them a little tiny bit. I could one animation move would be like this, and then I'd photograph that, and then I'd do that, and then photograph that, and then do that. Little tiny movements, and then what you're seeing is 12 of those movements a second. So to make about 6 seconds, I would do it overnight. I wouldn't do it during the day because the electricity in my neighborhood is much more level, you know, even. The lights stay kind of consistent. So I would usually shoot from about 10 at night until maybe 3 or 4 in the morning and have a 6-hour shoot. It's usually about an hour a second for this project. And that's much faster than... I know that, like, for Wallace and Gromit, it would be maybe a day for a second or two. So they're made out of... They have this metal armature, and then they have a clay face, and I made the cloth clothes that they're wearing. They right next to this, they're about 9 inches tall, so they would be about this big. The way that I combined them is I shot them separately in front of a blue screen or a green screen, and then I could get them positioned just right, and I would test it, go back and forth, and I use a digital camera so I can take a picture and then test how, like, for example, how the character was sitting right in this cavity right here. I could test to see if that was aligned just right. And I photographed the sculpture first and then with a macro lens, and then would set up the puppet animation and shoot the puppet animation so it appeared to be in the same space as this scaled down version of the sculpture. I'm trying to think. Yeah.
How large were the actual figures?
9 inches tall, so they were about this big.
Yeah. What was the bird
made? The bird is is also a painting. So it's made out of watercolor. I don't know. It's made out of ink on paper, and then I cut it out frame by frame.
I thought that the dust rag was the most animated thing in the whole segment. Was that intentional?
Which part?
The dust rag, rumbling in the wind, was the most animated.
Oh, right. Yeah, it was unavoidable, but it was also intentional. Like, every time you... move that little, like when I was with the amp, if you're going to move the arm, you have to touch the cloth on the sleeve. And so when I did my first early test, I realized that when I'm indoors, when I shoot indoor shots, I have to be very careful because I can't touch any of their clothes. But I have to move them, because if I touch their clothes, it'll look like their clothes are jumping around on it. But it really, really worked out really well in the outdoor shots, because then it just looked like he was up there and the wind was blowing. With that cloth thing, I would rub my finger around it every shot, and I would rub it around this way, and then I'd rub it around that way, and then it just kind of looked like it was blowing crazily. So once it was, you know, a happy accident. I didn't know that was going to happen. But once I saw the first shot, then I started doing it as a normal thing. Yeah. It's a clay with a high wax content, and it's made in Switzerland, I think, or France. No, I think it's made in Switzerland, and it's a little bit different than what the American clay animation people use. And it has it's a little bit better. It's lighter in terms of weight, which is kind of important, but. It's also more translucent, has more depth to it, and it's more resistant to heat, which is important because of the lights. So it doesn't get softer during the shoot.
So are you molding that with your hands or with the tool?
The mouths I do with this little cuticle pusher that you use to push it back, and it's got a really nice heart shape to it. And I can kind of dig in and open up the mouth or close it. But so as they're talking, I'm re-sculpting the face, you know, 100 times or something, and trying to keep it basically the same, but have the chin drop and the mouth open a little bit. And basically, they were too small to do much with my hands. I could bend the hands or do little things, but or rub them, but I can't do too much with my hands. because their heads were like this. Any other questions? Oh, yeah.
You spoke of the colorization, using the, I guess, the computer to fill in the color, and yet it's still kind of stark and bleak. Is that a, a choice that you made on purpose?
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to keep it, I wanted the background to drop back and to feel unified and separate from the characters. And I wanted it to feel like it wasn't full saturation. I think the most saturated thing is the car, maybe, because I thought it might be like a local color. It might be like the car paint itself. And I wanted there to be maybe high saturation in the clothes, so that the characters would kind of pop forward and the backgrounds would recede. I don't know why, but it seemed to connect it together as a painting. No, it's sort of an oil based. It's oil and wax together. Yeah.
There seemed to be a moment where there was like a romantic tension where I literally thought he was going to kiss her. Was that because he just for a brief second sort of went forward? I mean, it was like a second. Mm-hmm. Is that intentional? Or
it's a really interesting question because. I wanted there to be that tension in that scene, but you never know until the next morning after you shoot it what little subtle things they're going to do. And so I don't know if most of what they do that's subtle, I didn't consciously do. In order to make someone seem alive, you have to move them a little bit every frame. And so I might have been, honestly, I might have been thinking, okay, I'm going to have to move them a little bit closer because I want them to get close, but then I don't want them to stop because he'll seem dead. And then, so I have to move them a little bit back. But I might have had the thought that he needs to move closer just to get a little bit, to have that intimate sort of push. And then that caused it all becomes meaningful. With the music and the editing and the dialogue. And the dialogue comes later, so a lot of the dialogue decisions were weighted to give silences. I mean, when they're moving their mouths, it's going to be stuff where they're going to be saying words. But the time, sometimes I can adjust the timing of the animation and drop frames or extend things to give longer pauses. So in the end, I'm always surprised every morning by how they behaved last night, you know. Yeah.
You talked about the editing. Was most of that just small technical editing, or did you find yourself editing out part of the storyline and making it sound didn't work?
No, you wouldn't know the difference between the. It's a frame or two here and there. You have to be, since it takes. You have to be very efficient. So I made a really rough version. Just with cutout figures before for movement and timing. The whole thing is pretty much edited before I start animating. But these little tiny cuts sometimes give you a longer... I would usually shoot a couple extra frames at the beginning before an action and then a couple extra frames after. So there's just a little bit of timing to what... And also for music, you know, is it going to cut on that or is it going to be a little bit off? In terms of the how it relates to the sound. Yeah.
Did you have a written script so that you would keep on track?
Right at the beginning, I wrote down the general story. And the script was developed during the entire process. First, I would just sit there with the microphone and watch the movie, and I would, talk in and say what they were saying to each other, kind of with my charcoal drawings. I would say, "Hi, Jim." I'd say, "Oh, that doesn't sound right. You know, maybe his name should be something else." And or that's like, why would he say that? Like, I would reduce it so that well, that's obvious. He doesn't need to say that. Or why? Like, what's the motivation to go to the store? So I would say, let's get some salt. Let's get some something else. And I thought, well, it's snowing. And then I came up with the idea, let's get some salt. I might have said, can you help me get a new shovel? Because he was outside raking, or maybe. So I would just try some different things. And then I recorded that as I was going and did some editing. And then I would get real people to come in. And do the voices, so I could start thinking about it as being someone else's voice, not my own, because it sounded weird when the women were speaking with my voice. And then I went to Tuskegee, where Carver had his laboratory at Tuskegee University, and it's become a museum. There's two national parks to him, and I wanted mine to take place in an imaginary national park that was neither of the national parks. That was sort of the third one. And I went to Tuskegee, and they ran an ad in the paper to have people come in. So about 30 people came in, and I recorded them speaking the entire script. And then I went back to my studio and edited it and decided which recordings would match up with which faces after they were already animated. And it affected the piece tremendously to switch out one voice for another. That decision was about creating the chemistry between all four of the characters. Yeah.
Can you talk about your decision to display this statue on its own alongside the video?
Okay. The decision to display the statue with the video. Well, one thing I think is kind of interesting is the scale. In this room, the videos, the sculpture appears very large in some shots, and so it sort of is amplified to full scale as a monument. In here, I intentionally didn't shoot any shots of his face in the video, except there's one from maybe down here. But when you come in here, you can actually almost make eye contact with him if you're my height. But at least you can see the face, and you can look at some of the details in here. And I think that then you can have a relationship to the historical character, where in the video it's about the present problem of this man having a relationship with a woman who has a job that moves her around the country. And her having that relationship with her work and him having a relationship with his work. So I think in that room, it's sort of about a contemporary problem. And this is a chance to first kind of connect with the idea that this is Carver, and there are all kinds of complex things in anybody's life that make it difficult to balance work and love and the other sort of political aspects of it, to give it its own space so that it's like meeting Carver. And I'm never sure about those kinds of decisions. And so at a certain point, I go for it, and I see what kind of impact it has. So different people will have different relationships to it. When I was in Tuskegee, they had a movie playing in the basement that was talking about Carver's life. And I sat through it. I would go down maybe once a day and just kind of sit through it and listen to the movie to get a perspective on the project and see how people in the audience were looking and listening to it. And sometimes African Americans would come in and they would enjoy it, and other times they would be yelling out things like, you know, that's bullshit, and be very opposed to the idea that he was doing the right thing by being passive in the way that he was being passive. And so I thought, and the same was for the books. Once I got past the children's section of the library, you know, when you start looking at the books in college library, where, you know, where they're looking critically at his history, you realize that there's really, it's really complicated to figure out what you're supposed to do at a certain time politically, if you're going to be working on some kind of larger project like he did. Yes. Object versus monument. Monument.
Just the perception of the scale of that being monument versus an object, which you walk up to, probably more like most things in this world would be experienced. You know, they have a relationship with our physical, say, as opposed to the Sarah outside that you stand back from that you walk into. That has, I think that's kind of interesting as well. It breaks away from the storyline, but then maybe it does.
Right. I think that's right. And he's. I realized when I was looking for, I wanted to know what other sculptures have been made of Carver before, what, especially monuments, whether there had been any, and I couldn't find any that were life size. And now there is one that's life size that's at the Botanical Garden in St. Louis. Since my piece was completed, and I thought about that because of the because everyone is slightly smaller than life, so when you approach it, you have that object, and a lot of them are, you know, within this range. But some of them, the one that's at the Tuskegee Museum is kind of like this, and he wasn't like that. So it's just like a reduced, smaller version of him. But then when you think about a monument, then it takes some of the specific parts of the, it takes some of the specificity of the person away, and it blows it up into a large symbol. And so maybe in one sense, this can still be specific Carver, and you can have a relationship to it where you project yourself into it, and it doesn't push you off like the Lincoln who's sitting down. You know, that's more of a, it's not, you think of Lincoln, but you also think of Lincoln's relationship to the country, because it's a monument. So if this was actually enlarged to 150 feet, then I guess I would continue to think about it. I don't know what that would do. Right. So in this piece, this with Avu, this is the first time that I worked with this kind of sculpture next to the video, and I think it has a different. I did it for a different reason entirely than the piece that I did after this, which is called Dread. With Dread, I made five characters out of clay or resin, something that I could work with, and then I took it in two directions. One direction was I cast it in bronze and put a black patina on it. And the other direction was I worked with a foundry that 3D scans, computer scans, the surface, giving me a computer file that was the three-dimensional surface of the sculpture. That they use it for enlargement to monuments, but I didn't want them to make a monument out of it. I wanted them to just give me the file. Then I took the 3D file and animated it in the computer, so that what you see on the screen of the animation is a 3D scan of the sculpture. So in one room I had the physical sculpture, and in the other room I had just the surfaces, the hollow white, and they were colored white. So it was like kind of the white hollow surfaces, and in the other room there was the physical object. And I was thinking of that, in that specific piece, I was thinking of that as the difference between a physical object, and as you get closer and closer, you realize that there's the touch of the hand, and there's infinite amount of detail, and it's made up of smaller and smaller particles, and that being a sort of a metaphor for nature. As you start to look closer and closer at nature, your environment changes, and versus what was in the animation, which was a measured surface that had only a certain number of points on it, and you, as you get closer and closer, you start to see that it breaks down into flat planes. So it's strange because I was using the same sort of the same scenario, but thinking about but for a different reason. And I can't imagine, I don't know what I'm going to do next, and I don't know if it's going to be on that trajectory, but I think that the 3D scanning was so interesting and the material was so new to me that it opened up a new way of thinking about the disjunct between the mind and the environment. And I think that that's been a continuous thread through earlier pieces than Avu, and then in the following pieces is the way that characters essentially, even though you can talk, and you can be standing somewhere, that you're sort of disconnected from the space that you're in. One example is like when you're on the If you use a cell phone, when you're on the phone and you're in the park, sometimes you forget about the park, and you sort of go into an internal space. And so that's in a way how I see sometimes conversations go, is that sometimes you forget about the surroundings, and you feel inside of yourself. Yes. Yeah.
Do you feel that the pieces are autonomous?
I tried to make this autonomous, and I feel like it gets more interesting when they're shown together like this. But then if you saw this, it might be I think it would be autonomous but different. But I think it works best when they're next to each other. But the problem is when you watch this, you don't know who the guy is. You don't know who the bronze is. And you're not able to get a good look at it, really. And you don't have the historical connection. But you get a contemporary story, maybe. Or maybe a weird story that's somewhat contemporary and somewhat set in a time that's 30 or 40 years ago. And with this, it's a bronze sculpture, so it's in a way it's not new. It's also set in a different time. It'll work differently as you know if they're separate or more together. I'm not sure. Yeah.
We've just closed two fascinating shows here. And the Ron Hewitt show, where the issue then really was placement of the work of art. Were you looking down on the floor? Were you looking up to the tall figure? And I'm looking at this piece. How does it look different? Because did you choose the pedestal high or chosen here? What would happen if you put it on the floor? Anyway, are we looking up at it, down at it? What was your thinking as you placed it at that point?
Well, the pedestal dimensions are specific. I experimented with the height, and I wanted the when you're here, I thought you could identify. I mean, most people could probably identify with that shot where the guy's cleaning the hands, and you could almost enter it through that symbol. And I wanted the eye level to be above your eye level, so that you're looking up to him. So it is a monument still. I like his shoes, so that you get a close view of the shoes. because the shoes are very, they're not new, and they're very, and they're kind of like those handmade shoes that you would get. And so they're from a general store, but they're not the best, you know, they're not the best ones. And so that has a connection to the earth, I think. So, and you get a closer relationship to that, to realize that he's dressed in formal clothes, but that it's not a perfect suit. It's not that sort of thing. So I think that it might be a little clumsy that it's not, you know, that it's not, those are the decisions that I use for the height. And then roughly that proportion is probably, you know, the proportion of the body. And I like that he's sort of centered and straight on in this space that it's.
Well, it also reminds me of the Barnett Newman's we just seen.
Huh. Yeah.
Above the airframe, the object right in the middle, and then in the sense of the space.
He's very vertical.
Very vertical.
Yeah. And almost like a, like, you know, just structure-wise, it's, there wouldn't be any problems with it as a monument, because it doesn't have a weird center of gravity. Yeah.
How affected did you start with the whole dialogue where there was small plot? I mean, it seems like every single word drives the plot. There's no wasted word.
Yeah, it's not edited down, but it's edited over time. So through revisions.
Did you ever have where they were sitting up, did you ever have small thought where it was just them talking about whether
okay.
Just very direct?
It might be edited down by 80%. Like the most that they would have ever said might have been 20% more. Especially in the end. You know, I had to figure out a way for them to have that final conversation and for it to be concise and explain, or in the factory. I didn't want them to be talking forever in the factory. And I wanted her to, so when she says, "I'll call you," you know, I think that was maybe a later discovery where I could take I could suggest the whole future of the relationship at that point with three words. So it's edited down, but more of a through a process of replacement, and then that specifying what they were actually saying, then knowing everything that was going to happen first, and writing it all verbosely, and then kind of editing it down. Yeah.
I'm trying to recall the relative size of the figures, and they seem to be all much smaller than life size. Close, but relative to this statue,
it
would be about shoe size.
Right.
Homage to this.
Right. It would have to be bigger than. Well, I was thinking about the Statue of Liberty, or the Colossus at Rhodes, and different monuments that are at different heights, that are, you know, when something is decided. One of the most, I'm trying to think of the silly thing that I saw in Rome. I'm drawing a blank. No, in Rome, the person who liberated Italy, Garibaldi. Yeah. No, forget it. Forget it. But this monument to blank blank. Anyway, it's a large white monument. It looks like a wedding cake. And Vittorio Emanuele. Yeah, the monument to Vittorio Emanuele is like this enormous building that was built for this this person, and it's supposed to sort of blend into the city, but it still doesn't blend in for me. And it's really monumental size, and you see like flames burning and things like that to one individual. And I thought about him as being kind of in like incredibly modest in a way, but well, I mean, he was modest as a personally, but really promoted the kind of research that he was doing. So shifted the focus to the research, and sort of made himself in a way invisible through the way that he spoke about it. And I thought about that as being a really interesting way to be large. I thought about it as different kinds of artists, like the cleaning guy as a kind of artist who continuously, you know, and that would give him a year cycle to clean this thing, and he would be working on it continuously, but it would come out the same every time. Or, you know, and he would do a little bit each day, and then the pigeon comes. The pigeon doesn't actually... I got rid of that. Yeah. it was there at one point, and I took it out. Because I thought that in the same way that he respects the monument, then why would I do that, you know? But that's the reason that he goes up there, because he, from his vantage point, he can't see whether it happens or not. So he goes there just in case to clean it, just in case that happened. Well, he was looking up there to see if it had actually happened, yeah. I mean, that's my thought process, you know, yeah, that he was a little worried because he was eating lunch and then he looked up and he saw the pigeon land on there, and then so it kind of interrupted. Yeah.
I'm assuming that it is a peanut
flower. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's just a little curl. It came out different. There's three bronzes that were produced, and each one has sort of a different lapel because of the way that it came out, and then I had to sort of redo it on each one. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
There were other businesses like that, Douglas Kitchen.
Thank you. All right, so should we... okay, thanks a lot.